Turning in your Bibles to John chapter 5, that's where we'll be beginning our study this evening. I don't know if Mason did it intentionally or not, but his songs couldn't have been much better selected as we are continuing our study in the Gospel of John, and specifically looking at it from, I guess, more of a topical point of view than a straight through the text way of looking at it, where we're considering John's purpose, which he says he is writing to prove the reality of Jesus. He's writing so that we may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing we might have life in His name. And we're asking the question of how exactly John is going about this purpose of proving that Jesus is the Son of God. And we've examined the claims that John made about Jesus, and we've examined the claims that Jesus made concerning Himself. And we began last time by looking at the testimony provided by the Gospel of John, specifically the human testimony provided by by John in his gospel, of what different people said about him. And while the testimony is not the sort of thing that will prove to you guaranteed beyond all reasonable doubt that Jesus is in fact the Son of God from that human testimony, it does provide a lot of evidence for us, a lot of cases, one after the other, where everyone who sees Jesus walks away from Him impacted in one way or another. And tonight we're continuing our study by looking, by beginning to look at the testimony that the Father provides for Jesus. And specifically, we'll look at the miracles that John records this evening. And so if you're visiting with us this evening, I hope that gives you something of a background of where we're coming from and where we're going. And we're certainly glad that you've chosen to join us this evening in our assembly together. And after this lesson, we'll look at two other aspects of the Father's testimony, the fulfillment of prophecy in the Word of God that He provided before time that John finds fulfillment of, and then also, finally, the resurrection of Jesus and how that provides testimony from the Father before we turn to other areas and subsequent lessons after that. Well, in John chapter 5, we find Jesus healing the lame man at the pool of Bethesda. And after He does this, the Jews charge Him with breaking the Sabbath and making Himself equal with God. And Jesus replies to them by making what may be the most sweeping claim in reference to His work that is recorded in any of the Gospels. In chapter 5 and verse 19, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of His own accord, but only what He sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows Him all that He Himself is doing. And greater works than these will He show Him, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom He will." Jesus says, listen, I'm not doing anything special here. Well, I may be doing something special by your reasoning, but nothing that's just completely out of the ordinary. I'm just doing the things that God does. You're going to see even greater things in this coming. It's kind of like what He said to Nathanael. If you're amazed by this, just wait till what you see next. I'm going to do greater things than these. I will raise the dead. And speaking here, I believe, both of the physical dead and the spiritual dead as well. But He goes on to say that He has three specific works from the Father that He will do. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent Him. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears My word and believes Him who sent Me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming, and now is here, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in Himself, so has He granted the Son also to have life in Himself. And He has given Him authority to execute judgment, because He is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear His voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. He goes on to say that He has these three specific works from the Father that He is to do. First of all, He will judge, just as God has judged. In all of this, he is also implicitly confessing the very thing that they charged Him with, that He is, in fact, claiming equality with God. But he will judge. And also he says that life is in his word. Life is in his voice. The very things that he teaches, the things that he will continue to teach, are the things that will provide life to those who hear and respond. And finally, the resurrection, that he will raise the dead and give eternal life to those who have heard his voice and done it. But he doesn't just make these claims in a vacuum. He doesn't just make them and then walk away from them. He very quickly affirms that God would bear witness of all of these things that he is claiming. In verse 36, "The testimony that I have is greater than that of John. For the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing, bear witness about me that the Father has sent me. And the Father who has sent me has himself borne witness about me. His voice you have never heard, his form you have never seen." And he goes on to talk about how they don't know God the way that they should. But what is most significant here is he says, God is going to bear witness about all of this. The Father is going to bear witness that I will be doing these things. He will confirm to you the claims that I am making. Well, how is he going to do this, Jesus? He will do this by the works that Jesus is doing. And in this we find one of the main purposes of the miracles that Jesus did while he was on the earth. He's not just healing those in infirmity. He's not just going around because he's a nice, compassionate guy and he sees people that need to be healed and therefore he's going to heal them because he's a good person at heart. He is doing these things to confirm his claim to be the Son of God. And it's not just in this instance that he makes this claim, but it's the same thing that he says in other places as well. For example, in John chapter 10, he says the same basic thing. In John chapter 10 and verse 25, Jesus says, "I told you and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me." The things that I'm doing, the miracles that I'm doing, the great signs that you see me performing, these are the very things that confirm that I am who I say I am. The miracles were part of God's testimony to who he was. It's the same point that Peter is making over in his first sermon in Acts chapter 2. Peter understood this and he wanted us to understand it as well. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 22, Peter says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know." And he goes on to preach his sermon from that point. But it begins by saying Jesus was a man who was attested to you by God. Well, how did Jesus attest this to you by, or how did God attest this to you? Well, he did so by the works that he performed. It's the same thing Peter then goes on to say to Cornelius in Acts chapter 10 and verse 38. How God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. He went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. How can we know that Jesus came from God? What is the proof that Jesus came from God? Well, it is the very miracles that he did. The proof that God was with him, that God anointed him with the Holy Spirit, that he was doing these things in God's name. That's how we know that Jesus was in fact from God. That's the verification for the claims that he made. Would God have really done these works through a man who was a bald-faced liar? Who was going around trying to deceive the world, the most despicable con man in history? Would God have done these things through that person? Would he have done them through a lunatic running around saying that God would verify his claims when really he was completely off his rocker and God was never with him at all? Well, tonight we're going to examine the Father's testimony to Jesus through these miracles in the Gospel of John. And we're going to do it in two parts. First, we'll look at the witness to the miracles, how we can know that they in fact did happen in history, as we were singing about. But then also, we'll look at the witness of the miracles, what they demonstrate to us about the nature of Jesus. Well, first of all, we'll start with the witness to the miracles. How can we know that these things really happened? And we can look at this in a couple of ways. First of all, we'll talk about some of the general testimony to the miracles themselves before we look at a couple of cases of some specific testimony to the miracles. And as we consider this general testimony, before we look at these specific passages, one of the things that I think is very helpful to remember is that the enemies of Jesus never denied his miracles. They only denied the source of his power. All they ever said that he didn't do was do miracles by the hand of God. They never said that he didn't do any miracles. And if you want to talk about some of the most powerful testimony that you could possibly have for something you're trying to prove, it's when your enemies admit that you did something. The very people who want to put you to death for the things that you're teaching, when they are the ones who are admitting that you are in fact doing these things, that's some pretty strong testimony to the fact that it actually happened. And on top of that, Jesus and his disciples never at any point made any effort whatsoever to prove that a miracle had been accomplished. Jesus didn't finish all of his miracles by saying, "Look, nothing up the sleeve. No sleight of hand here. You can look for mirrors and strings anywhere and you won't find them." There was never any need to prove that it happened. This whole discussion about whether miracles existed in a historical context, that's a wholly modern question. That was not a question in the original context. Jesus tried to, or didn't try to prove them. His enemies never denied them. In the original context of the miracles, they were recognized for what they were and they were accepted by all. The only question was whether or not Jesus did them by the hand of God. And the enemies were clearly biased and their conclusion about that. Well, if we can consider this general testimony with some specific examples of general testimony, if we're not getting ourselves into too big of a paradox there, we'll look at what Nicodemus says starting in John chapter 3 and verse 2. Nicodemus comes to Jesus by night, as you know, and he says, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs you do unless God is with him." Nicodemus comes and the very first thing that he does is acknowledge that the miracles actually happened. Now, he's not talking about anything specific. This is right after the Passover where it says that Jesus was doing many signs. So that's probably what is under discussion here. He saw these things happen. But this is just kind of general testimony to the existence of the miracles in general. Nicodemus says, "I saw them, I know that they happened, and I don't question their authenticity." Also, there's the testimony of the multitude in John chapter 7. Now, this multitude, as we talked about last time, is an interesting group to consider their testimony because they have something of a mixed testimony. They don't all agree with one another. They look at Jesus and they have different perspectives and different conclusions as to what is going on. But one thing that they are absolutely certain of is that the miracles Jesus did were real miracles. Whether or not they believed in him, that's a whole different question. But they all understood that these things actually happened. In John chapter 7 and verse 31, many of the people believed in him. They said, "When the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done?" And it's not just people who believed in him like Nicodemus. It's not just the multitude who was of this mixed opinion, but even the Pharisees in John chapter 11, the enemies of Jesus, as we were just talking about, admit that he in fact did do these things. In John chapter 11 and verse 47, right after the healing of, or the resurrection of Lazarus, I guess that is something of a healing, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs." It's not just that he had this one really great trick that he did, and they're all befuddled about this one thing that he did. They're acknowledging not only did he do one miracle in raising Lazarus, but they're acknowledging all of the miracles that Jesus has done. He's done many signs. He's done many miracles. No one among the various classes of the Jews, no one who was in Jesus' audience at any point debated the existence of the miracles. They all recognized them as such and testified to the fact that these things in fact happened. And there are a couple of examples that we can look at in the Gospel of John is testimony to some specific miracles that these things did in fact happen. Probably the one that we have the greatest amount of testimony for is in the healing of the blind man, where everyone who saw it admitted that something amazing happened in this regard. There are, first of all, the neighbors, the acquaintances, we might say, of the blind man in verses 8 through 10. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him. He kept saying, 'I am the man.'" So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes open?" And he goes on to testify on his own from that point. But this is, again, something of a mixed reaction. A lot of people were saying, "This has got to be the same guy." And the rest of them were saying, "No, it can't be him." The reason they were saying that is because he could see, not because they were confused about his identity. If he hadn't had his eyes open, they would have had no question that this was the same man. They all recognized that this was, in fact, that person. The parents also testified to the existence of this miracle, that it actually happened. His parents answered in verse 20, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." The Pharisees were divided in this issue. Some had raised a charge against Jesus verse 16, "He is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others, probably others of the Pharisees, I think, since some of them said one thing, others said the other, they said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So again, the Pharisees, the enemies of Jesus, acknowledged that this was a miracle that happened. The Jews in the next chapter speak of this same thing. And again, when we talk about the Jews in the Gospel of John, we're not talking about the Jewish ethnic group, but the Jewish leaders who are opposed to Jesus. So again, this is another group who are divided about this. Some are saying he's a demon and he's insane. Why would you listen to him? And others said, "These are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" And then finally, the blind man himself testifies repeatedly to this miracle happening. That is his constant refrain through this story. "What is wrong with you people? Why don't you get it? I was blind, but now I see." That's the fundamental point here. And he says that repeatedly. He says it in verse 11, after they ask, "How were your eyes open?" He said, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed, and I received my sight." In verse 15, the Pharisees again asked him how he received his sight, and he said, "He put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." In verse 25, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." And in verse 30, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes." The testimony of everybody involved here was that it happened. His neighbors were curious, his parents were afraid, the Pharisees were angry, and the blind man himself was convinced. But never once is there a question as to whether or not it actually happened. Only how it happened is in question. Everybody involved bears witness to the miracle itself. And the same thing we see also in the raising of Lazarus. The last miracle recorded by John, kind of that straw that broke the camel's back that really drove them to finally saying, "You know what, we got to end this Jesus problem. We have to put him to death because he's raising other people from the dead. That's just too much. We can't take this anymore. We've got to kill this Jesus." Yet in the very process of deciding that, they make the admission that Jesus does many signs in the verse that we read earlier. And then the next day at the triumphal entry, the crowds who were there to hear him and to see him, they were talking about this as well. In chapter 12 and verse 17, the crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. The reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they heard he had done the sign. So people, everyone who was there who saw it, they're going about talking about this amazing thing that Jesus did. And again, there was never a question raised by any as to the signs themselves. The testimony of everybody in every instance where we have any information about it is that the signs were factual. The problem was that some refused to accept what the signs pointed to, that Jesus was in fact the Son of God, and that this was the Father bearing witness to those very claims. So we can look at these signs and have a very good basis of knowing that they actually did in fact happen. There is good testimony to the signs. The question then for us to consider the rest of this evening is, what do the signs themselves say? We turn our focus to the witness of the miracles. What do they teach us about Jesus? Very often when we talk about miracles, we talk about them as something that is a contradiction to the law of nature. If there is something that happens, something that somebody does that violates natural law, if there's no possible way for natural law to explain that, well, that's a miracle. And I guess on the one hand, that's a fair enough explanation of a miracle. But it may be better to look at it, and instead of saying that it's something that natural law can't explain, perhaps it's better to look at it as the intervention of a higher law than the one that usually governs a particular realm. When the law writer steps into nature, the laws themselves listen to what he has to say. Jesus' miracles are nothing more than the natural result of God coming to earth. And what John is setting about to do as he records these miracles is to show that Jesus was in fact God on the earth, that he had authority over every realm in which he interacted. Now, what exactly was John's point in recording these seven specific miracles? You know, I'm not entirely sure I could tell you what his exact intent was in choosing each of those and what he is trying to prove in each of those. And the points that we'll look at tonight may or may not have been John's conscious intent in recording these particular miracles, but I do think that it's at least one fair interpretive approach in looking at them, that we're not doing any stretching outside the context by saying the things that we'll say this evening. And at the very least, I think it's clear that John does select miracles that show a wide range of the authority and the power of Jesus. These miracles do certainly do the things that we'll say they do this evening. But ultimately, the point of these miracles seems to be that Jesus has the power that belonged to God alone. That the miracles were direct evidence of his claim to be Savior and his claim to be shepherd and his claim to be the sustainer of man and his needs. They substantiate the claims that he came from God to reveal God and is one with God. And ultimately, as we've said before, that they are the very testimony to his identity. Well, apart from the resurrection of Jesus, which I said we'll look at in a separate lesson later on, John records seven miracles that we'll briefly look at tonight to see what the Father says about Jesus in each of these. And we're not going to take a lot of time to talk about the details of the miracle and what the miracle teaches. That's kind of outside the context of what we're trying to accomplish this evening. We will take the time to read each of these accounts so we can have it a little bit more fresh in our mind and make a couple comments about it perhaps, and then see what it may be saying to us about who Jesus is and how it proves John's claim that Jesus is in fact the Son of God. We'll begin in John chapter 2, the turning of the water to wine. John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. On the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Well, we begin with the result of this miracle, that the disciples saw it and believed. And this is one of the constant themes of the miracles of John that we won't point out in every instance. But if John's purpose is, in fact, to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, that we can believe that, and what we see happening over and over and over as Jesus performs these miracles, as the people see them, the people recognize that they actually happened, and the people believe, then clearly that is one of the things that these miracle stories are driving at. But beyond that, it does seem to me that these miracles show Jesus' authority and Jesus' power in a variety of ways. And this particular miracle shows us that Jesus is in fact the master of matter. No matter what it is, when he wills for something to happen, that thing will obey him. He looks at water and says, that water needs to be wine. The wine or the water is going to obey him because he is the creator of the water. He is the master of the water, and it must, in fact, do what he says. It's the same thing that you see in the temptation of Jesus. When Satan says, turn this stone into bread, if he couldn't do that, that's not a temptation for him. But he could have, in fact, turned the stone to bread. Why? Because he was the creator of the stone. He was the master of the stone. And when he wills, it must obey. In chapter 4, we find the next of the miracles of Jesus, the healing of the nobleman's son. In John chapter 4, beginning in verse 46, so he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him. The father knew that was the very hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Again, you see the people believing at the end of this miracle. Everyone who saw it acknowledged that it happens, and their faith is strengthened. They believe in Jesus. But that's not the first time this nobleman believes. He believes at the word of Jesus. As soon as Jesus says, your son is going to be fine, he believes at that instance. There's no remarkable display of power. It's not like Naaman all over again where he says, come on, Jesus, you got to do something a little bit bigger and grander than that for me to believe. He just hears the word and that's enough. And then he has a long journey home for confirmation. He's put his faith in Jesus and has to turn around and go back home 15 miles or so. And when he gets there, he finds that his son is healed. And obviously, just like so many of the miracles of Jesus, this shows his power over sickness and illness and disease and the forces that destroy the body, because he is the creator of the body, because sickness and disease is a result of sin and he is holy. But really what this shows that I want to focus on this evening is that he is the master of distance and space, that there are no barriers to the power of God. And thus there are no barriers to the power of Jesus. Whether it is the 15 miles that Jesus was from this boy or the 15 inches that Jesus was from so many other people that he healed, it doesn't matter. When it is God himself in the flesh wielding this power and this authority. In the next chapter we find Jesus healing the lame man. After this, there was the feast of the Jews and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I am going, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. This man had been in his infirmity for 38 years. The healing of this man wasn't just fixing whatever was wrong with his legs. I mean, sometimes we read these stories of the healing of a lame man and we think that Jesus fixed his legs and that was the end of it. He could get up and walk after that point. But it's the bypass of not just the injury to the legs or the spine or whatever it may have been that left this man lame. It was 38 years of atrophy. You hear about somebody these days who has had a stroke and they can't walk for 6 months and then they have to go through inordinate physical therapy in order to walk again. Sometimes, if it has affected their brain, they have to learn how to walk again. It's 38 years of atrophy that Jesus bypasses in a moment. It's however much physical therapy that we might think in our terms, however much relearning how to walk that would have been necessary in this instance. Again, there is the disease. Again, there is the destruction of the body. But here we see Jesus as the master of time. Whether it's 38 years like this man has been lame or 38 seconds like may have been the time after Malchus' ear was cut off, it makes no difference to Jesus how long it was. Jesus can heal instantly and immediately, without any regard for how much time it should take, how much time has passed. In the next chapter, we find Jesus feeding the 5,000. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing a large crowd that was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This indeed is the prophet who is to come into the world." Again, we see them believing at the end of this miracle. And this is a miracle that points us to not just a physical miracle, but the spiritual demonstration of that as well, which really all of these miracles, we could take the time and say, what are they teaching us spiritually about Jesus? But here, it's very clear that Jesus has claimed to provide for our needs, and here he does so physically and by analogy to provide for our spiritual needs. And this is, in fact, how Jesus applies this miracle the next day when he begins to talk about the bread of life. He's not making that discourse about the bread of life in a vacuum. He's relating it to the miracle that he had performed this day and talking about how he will provide for our spiritual needs just as he provided for the physical needs. But for this miracle itself, in the context of what it shows us about Jesus and his authority and his power while he was here on the earth, we might say that shows us that he was the master of quantity. Without wheat fields, without a millstone, without any need for making dough or putting it in the oven, in a moment's time, Jesus produces the quantity necessary for the need and far beyond that point. Jesus doesn't need all of the little things that we think are necessary in providing a meal big enough to feed 5,000 because he is the Son of God. He can provide it in an instant. Well, Jesus then withdraws from the people because he understands they want to take him and make him a king. And then his disciples are out on the sea in their boat. In verse 16, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because of a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened, but he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Again, this isn't just a miracle. This is something greater than that. It's a demonstration of concern for his own. Here Jesus has gone away because he wanted to be alone. He wanted to be away from people for a while. And then he sees his disciples are in need. And so he leaves that solitude that he wanted because he cares for them. In the midst of the storm, he comes to them. And it's a great lesson for us. It's a great reminder to us that he is always present in our time of need. But for our purposes this evening, it shows him to be the master of nature. That wind and waves submit to him. even as we sing this evening. But He is the Lord of gravity and its power. Can you imagine walking on water? I mean, that's one of those things that we've read the story so many times, I think we've lost the significance, the great power that there is in not succumbing to the force of gravity. When was the last time you didn't succumb to the force of gravity? Anybody? Jesus stepped on water and did not sink. And again, He's not just breaking the laws of nature. It's not just that something happened and nature can't explain it. It's the arrival of the author of those very laws. And when He speaks and when He acts, even the laws themselves submit to Him. Chapter 9 is the healing of the man who was born blind. And we've talked about that in some detail already as far as the testimony that is given surrounding this miracle. But we'll pick up the first 7 verses to look at the miracle itself briefly. As He passed by, He saw a man blind from birth. And His disciples asked Him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not this man who sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, He spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. And then He anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. John says at the outset of this gospel that Jesus was the light that has come into the world to overcome the darkness. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world." And what this miracle does very clearly is confirm that He is indeed and in fact the master of the light who exercises control over the power of darkness. The blind man goes on to say that there's never been a story any time in history of someone who was born blind being healed before. Why do you suppose that is? Let me suggest to you that maybe it's because God is the only one who can give light. And before this point, God had never taken on flesh and come into the earth where He could provide this kind of physical light. And again, there is in this a greater teaching than just physical blindness, and that's the point that the story goes on to make, and perhaps at a later time we can come back and examine that greater spiritual teaching in more depth. Well, finally, then, there is the story of the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11. Verse 39, Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to Him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up His eyes and said, "Father, I thank You that You have heard me. I knew that You always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that You sent me." When He had said these things, He cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." I don't suppose you have to have too much of a crystal ball to understand what I'm going to say next, that this shows us that Jesus was the master of death and the giver of life. And in this sign, He shows not just His power over the death of Lazarus, but He gives His personal guarantee that everybody lying in a tomb will one day hear His voice and come forth. You know, if we're somewhat skeptical, we may look at all of this and say, "Yeah, but we've never seen a miracle with our own eyes. We've never seen this kind of testimony. How are we supposed to believe today?" And that is certainly true that none of us have ever seen a miracle, and it's because miracles served their purpose long ago, and so God has not used them to serve that purpose anymore. But even so, I think there is good reason to be sure of their existence. Again, even His enemies admitted that they happened. But the real weight of all of this testimony from these miracles isn't just the flexing of divine muscles. It's not just looking at each of them and saying, "Well, this shows He's the master of this, and this shows that He's the master of that," and so forth and so on. And while all these miracles, I do think, show those things about Jesus and His power and His authority, the real weight of these miracles is in the moral character of these signs. And each of them, there is a relation between what Jesus teaches about Himself and what He proves by the miracle that He does. And the result in every case is that the people believed when they saw the miracle. Jesus says that He's a light. Well, He proves it by giving light to the blind man. He says that He provides for all of our needs. Well, He proves it by making food out of near thin air. He says He's the resurrection. He proves it by raising Lazarus from the dead. He says that He's God. He proves it by healing with no regard to distance or time, just like an all-powerful, all-present, eternal being would be able to do. You see, the miracles aren't just proof of a revelation. The miracles are themselves the revelation. They reveal to us the true nature of Jesus, that He is, in fact, God in the flesh. They testify to us, the testimony from God Himself, that the claims of Jesus are true, that He is from God, and that His message is from God. And perhaps the greatest miracle of all that Jesus can do is the miracle that He does today. We say we've not seen any miracles, and in a sense that's true. But Jesus today can take a corrupt, vile, broken person like me and transform him into the image of Himself. He can take my wicked nature and replace it with the divine nature. Jesus is the light of the world, because He has come to outshine the darkness that is in this world. He will take our broken, corrupt selves and radically transform it if we just let Him. He is able to deliver you. And so that's the question for each of us this evening. Has He delivered me? If there's some way that we can help you, won't you come while we stand and sing?